Hello, and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Harm reduction started as a public health strategy with needle exchanges in the 80s in Holland to address the spread of hepatitis among IV drug users. And when AIDS came along, it took off, and now it's worldwide. Harm reduction therapy, and I quote, is a non-judgmental approach to helping substance users reduce the negative impact of drugs and alcohol in their lives. My guest is the foremost leader in harm reduction therapy. Her harm reduction therapy center is right here in San Francisco. We're lucky to have her. She's the author of Practicing Harm Reduction Psychotherapy and Over the Influence, the Harm Reduction Guide for Managing Drugs. Dr. Pat Dunning, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you for having me.
So great to have you here. You're a true pioneer, a worldwide leader in this, and it's thrilling to sit here with a master.
Thank you.
Well, I mean that. I'd like to know first why you had to come up with harm reduction therapy. Harm reduction was already happening worldwide, but why the harm reduction therapy, which you've invented pretty much?
Well, what I realized in working in San Francisco during the HIV epidemic, I was the director of the mental health clinic at the Mission Castro Health Center. In 1983, and HIV was taking off, and all of a sudden, all of these young men were dying, for one thing, and starting to misuse substances in ways that they never had before. And when I would suggest to them that they go to drug treatment, they would all come back and say they didn't like it. And what I realized is that we had to have something that really met the needs of people, and particularly the gay and lesbian community were already suffering with a lot of stigma. Now there is this, you know, what they're calling the gay epidemic.
The gay cancer.
The gay cancer.
And now the epidemic.
And right. And so the shame and the stigma was just being magnified over and over again, and that was what they were experiencing in traditional treatment as well.
And the LGBT community has had higher incidences of tobacco use, alcohol and drug problems.
Right.
Because of the stigma of being gay.
Exactly.
And that still exists to this day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the only way you could meet people was to go to a bar.
Right, right.
Back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so your experience during that the AIDS crisis led you to think we've got to find a way to treat people and not demand that they stop using.
Right. We have to find a way of treating people and understanding that people use drugs for only two reasons, to either increase pleasure or to decrease pain. And it's those reasons that drive the substance use in the first place. And it's those reasons that have to be attended to. In fact, people who use drugs only to increase pleasure rarely end up with a drug problem. It's people who use drugs...
Who self-medicate.
Yeah, it's people who self-medicate that end up with serious drug problems. And these men originally, and the clients that we see now, a lot of them are self-medicating a lot of hurt, a lot of trauma, a lot of depression. And so drugs work. I mean, people aren't stupid. You know, we do things that work.
It's such a refreshing approach to shaming people into abstinence,
right?
Which is a path, but this is a different path.
It's a different path, and I think it's based on the realization that there really is no us and them. You know, there's not those of us who don't use drugs and those of us who do. We all probably use some kind of substance. I don't know how many people had coffee this morning or tea or drinking a Diet Coke right now.
Xanax.
You know, so there's a way of breaking down the stigma by recognizing that not only are we all the same, but that the way that we do treatment has to pay attention to what the client knows about themselves. Not just what we as professionals know.
Instead of a more parental sort of, you need to just stop doing this.
Right, exactly.
It's
exactly.
Like, you know what you need.
Uh-huh. You know what you need, and you can probably tell us what the barriers are in your life to change. And
let's talk about that for a second. Mm-hmm. The barriers to change, like why they're abusing drugs instead of just enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, if you ask a person to do kind of a decisional balance, what are the pros of changing? What are the cons of changing? Say I'm doing too much crystal meth. You know, well, the pros of changing is that I'd save some money. I might save my job, my health, you know, the cons.
Relationships.
Might be, well, but all my friends do it, and what do I do with my friends? And I'm kind of shy. How would I have sex anymore? So those are the things that need to be addressed in treatment. How are you going to deal with friends? How are you going to deal with sex? For other people, it's, I can't sleep at night because I have nightmares of past trauma. So you're not going to be able to work with the substance misuse unless you get at what those barriers are, the things that
work. Kind of getting deep inside people's pain.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's why harm reduction therapy is really this, it's a revolutionary collaboration between a client and the therapist. And it recognizes that people change, that people take time to change. And there are many roads and many outcomes.
And the drug use is on, and alcohol use is on a continuum, and it shifts over the course of a lifetime.
Absolutely, absolutely. It doesn't necessarily progress toward death.
How is that different? I'm talking to Dr. Pat Denning here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. How is that different from the AA, or rather disease model?
Mm-hmm.
There's a disease model. Well, alcoholism is a disease,
right?
And so we treat it as, you know, as a disease from the AMA's point of view. They're calling it a disease. What's different about your approach in that regard?
Well, what's different is that I think that thinking about addiction, if we'll use that word, or serious drug misuse, thinking of it as only a brain disease leaves out a huge proportion of other contributing factors. Absolutely, there are brain changes in the brain with continued use. Absolutely, the reward center is pushed off kilter, causes cravings, causes people to really miss the drugs. And there's also a huge array of psychological issues and sociocultural issues that all come into play. It's a model that we call drug mindset and setting, and that the relative weight of those factors is going to be different for each person. Some people, their drug misuse is going to be driven by biology. Other people, it's going to be driven by trauma or depression. And for other people, it's going to be driven by their peer group. So to call it just a brain disease means you are not going to successfully treat the person.
Well, it also says that you're not responsible. It's a disease.
Well, that's kind of the paradox, is that on the one hand, it's a disease and you're not responsible. On the other hand, the treatment is not a medical treatment. You know, the treatment is a combination of abstinence from all drugs.
And talk therapy, meetings.
Meetings, which isn't therapy. It's a spiritual community.
Right.
So you're offering people a spiritual program of recovery from what they're calling a brain disease. It's just not, it's overly simplified. And I think that's why it doesn't work for a lot of people. And that's why a lot of people find it not helpful. They feel ignored.
Well, or they're agnostic or they're atheists,
right,
and they feel alienated. But there are finally, I know about this, that there are finally atheist AA meetings.
Right. Uh-huh. Right.
Or they don't do the higher power thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that works for those people now, right, that exists, but that took a long time,
right,
in coming. And the AA model is a very old model, 70-some years,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a brand new. How old is harm reduction therapy?
Harm reduction therapy, I started developing it with the help of Alan Marlatt at the University of Washington in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably 97. Another person, Andrew Tatarsky on the East Coast, was also working on it at the same time. I published my first book in 2000, and that was...
So it's less than 20 years, but
yeah,
it's going on the two decades mark.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the reaction, tell me a little bit about how harm reduction therapy, what you're doing, Pat Denning, is perceived around the country and around the nation by health care professionals, by mental health care professionals.
You know, it continues to be controversial. It was more so before the Obama administration, when the federal government wouldn't allow you to use the word harm reduction in grants. So now you can at least apply for grants with that word in it. But it's still controversial, and part of it, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is because people are not sure what we're talking about when we talk about harm reduction. You know, so there's the public health aspect of harm reduction, which is needle exchange. In order to save lives, in order to
and not drinking and driving is
and
part
not
of harm
drinking
reduction.
And driving, right?
Public
and
health,
helmet laws, and seatbelt laws. All of that stuff is really harm reduction. And then there's advocacy, which are the policymakers and the lawyers who are fighting to end the war on drugs and get people out of jail. And then there's treatment. And where I come in really is in the treatment end, and people have misconceptions about it. I think that the other thing is that the American public has really bought the idea that this is a brain disease and the only cure is what I call the miracle of 28 days, which is rehab, and that, and then a lifelong of AA or NA meetings, and that, and so anything that comes in that challenges that is makes people very defensive. On the other hand, when I do a lot of trainings around the country and around the world, when I actually get to sit with people who are in traditional treatment programs and we can talk about some of these ideas and principles, people start opening up and going, oh, well, yeah, I guess there is, that is a different way of looking at it. I think that maybe that could help people.
Dr. Pat Dunning is my guest here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. She's the author of Practicing Harm Reduction Psychotherapy and Over the Influence, the Harm Reduction Guide for Managing Drugs. She's the founder of Harm Reduction Therapy, the center here in San Francisco. You can find out more at harmreductiontherapy.org. Please check it out. Well, it sounds like you're on the defensive somewhat sometimes in terms of you travel worldwide, you make these speeches, and, you know, you're dealing with some combative environments sometimes, and yet you're fighting the good fight. It's growing.
Yes.
It's expanding.
It is. It's growing and it's expanding in areas that I hadn't really originally thought of. So, you know, a lot of the housing for poor people and dealing with homeless folks who are seriously mentally ill and drug addicted, that there are a lot of people who are the clerks at the SRO hotels who deal with these people all the time, the maintenance workers, the case managers. We're training all of them in the principles of harm reduction therapy because everybody has a relationship with someone that can be healing. So the harm reduction therapy has expanded into an areas in the city where clinicians aren't working.
Wow. So it's such a different thing to, in other words, to accept that you're using, to accept that you're drunk, to accept that you got drunk, so to accept that as a therapist and even as these various people you just described, these workers who come into contact with these people that require treatment or that may require treatment or that are definitely needing some help. And it's a sense of not shaming them and not judging them, but trying to just accept that that's a real thing that they're doing and separate that from even them.
Yeah, I think that I think there is a fundamental question. It's kind of it's a little provocative maybe, but the fundamental question really is a moral question. Is it okay to get high? You know, really, is it okay? Do you...
Human beings have been doing it since they began.
Absolutely, but...
It's a natural tendency of our humanity.
Yeah, but we have judgments about it. And so, is it okay to get high? And if so, for whom? And under what conditions? And with what kind of drugs? And when we start asking ourselves those questions, we come up with all sorts of prejudices and all sorts of biases. So I think that's the starting point. And the thing is that when our clients come in to see us, they come in with all the same judgments about themselves.
Because it's cultural.
Yeah. And so people come in and they'll say to me, oh, I'm just a drunk. I need to quit drinking. And my first response often is, wow, that sounds kind of harsh. And why would you want to quit drinking? So I open up the conversation to let the person understand, you don't have to tell me what I think you need to say in order to be accepted here. I want to hear really what's going on in your life. Why are you drinking and why would you think of quitting?
It's very powerful. It's so powerful because it's so revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just fresh. It's like a new horizon on this, a new way of thinking about it.
Well, right. And clients who come in after the first session, they're saying, I've never talked about my drug use this way before. I've never been this honest. Or nobody's ever asked me these kinds of questions that really help me think about it rather than try and hide.
Right.
Yeah.
And try to pretend I'm better than I am and be secretively doing things that are causing me harm.
Yeah. And as a therapist, it's really satisfying to see a person, you know, finally be able to open up about what they've been doing and how bad they feel and the harms that they're causing either themselves or others, which they haven't been able to say without judgment. And so they can talk to us and we can start working with them. Well, what's the biggest harm? Who are you harming? How's that happening? You know, what can we do to keep you from drinking and driving? You know, that would be the first thing. How, you know that it's not a good idea. We know it's not a good idea. How can we help you not do that anymore?
Wow. Dr. Pat Denning is my guest here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining us. What are the effects of shame on the treatment, the person who's being treated? Talk a little bit about shame, and then tell us a little bit about some of the tools and techniques you use, besides the one you just described, how you would talk to that person to treat your clients.
Mm-hmm. One of the effects of shame is that it, first of all, prevents people from coming to treatment until their problems tend to be more serious or out of hand. There's some research recently that showed that people who know that they have a serious alcohol problem wait 10 years before they get treatment. And some people would argue, well, that's because they just want to keep drinking. And my thought about it is that people don't want to go to AA, or people don't want to be shamed. They don't want to admit it. They don't know if they want to change or not. So they're ambivalent. They're confused and ambivalent, and so they wait, and they drink, some more. And then it becomes obvious to them and everybody else.
They might lose their partner. They might lose some supportive friends and family.
Absolutely.
They might get a DUI.
Yeah, exactly. And so, this problem has progressed, and that's part of shame. And that's also part of the reality is that there are not enough options for different kinds of treatment. You know, people think, oh, my God, I'm not going to go to rehab. I've got a job, or I've got a family, or I've got a dog.
Well, it changes your self-image.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's one of the things.
Your sense of self and who you think you are in the world. You're like, oh, well, now I'm in rehab? Me? I have what?
Right. Uh-huh. Right. And now you have to adopt an identity as an addict.
In a community of abstinence, then you easily become part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a sort of taking on an identity that isn't necessarily authentic.
Right. It's not necessarily authentic. And it's certainly, even if it's authentic in its piece, it's still not the whole story. It's not who a person is.
Let me ask you this. You're in counseling with somebody. You're in therapy with a client. And they're really doing harm to themselves and others. They're doing some things that are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, as a healthcare professional, how do you cope with that? And what do you say to try to get them to change the behavior without the judgment that mm-hmm. can come so easily?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Well, the first thing is the coping with it. And I think that's the hardest
thing. For you,
yes. That's the hardest thing about
doing
this. Going
home at night
work.
And saying, what am I?
Well, just sitting in the session with somebody who's telling you things that you
just
know are dangerous. You just kind of hang on to your chair and try not to, have your eyebrows go up too much. So the first thing is just managing your own anxiety. Mm-hmm. Sometimes managing your own irritation. It's like, I can't believe you're driving with your kids in the car.
You idiot. You know?
Right, exactly.
Like a regular citizen would in reaction to finding that out.
Right.
I mean, you're a person, you're
right,
a citizen.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that when you're dealing with really dangerous behaviors, the best approach is really direct, which is to say, you're talking to me about a lot of things that have a potential for really causing you a lot of harm. Is that something that you're concerned about? Have you been thinking about that too? Because I'm over here, I'm really worried for you. Yeah. And see what the response is.
Have there been some good success stories you could share with us?
Oh, there's been a great success
story.
Yeah, a man that used to go out on drinking binges after work with colleagues and people in from out of town. And he would drive his car to work, and then he'd get in his car and he'd drive home, which is, not a good idea. And what we eventually came up with pretty quickly is that if he knew he was going out afterwards with friends to drink, he wouldn't drive to work in the first place. So that got put into place. So then he'd have to take a cab home. If he didn't know and he drove to work and he ended up going out with colleagues or friends, then when he walked into the bar, he handed his car keys to the bartender and said to him, when I come and ask you for my car keys, that's the time for you to call me a cab. And that was...
Strategies. Techniques.
Yeah. And that was the beginning. Yes, a plan. That was the beginning of him dealing with a drinking problem by tackling the harms that were going to accrue to him, society, and other people first.
Which also makes him admit it to himself that he's drinking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It makes him see that instead of, oh, I'm going to have a few, I'll be fine.
Right, right, exactly, yeah.
Well, actually, I'm going to have a few. I'm going to have a few again. I'm going to have a lot.
Right.
Actually, I had a fun six, you know, like.
Right, I got to give my keys to the bartender.
Begins to be an awareness when you start changing the behaviors around harm reduction, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Well, exactly, and this person went on to get control of his drinking, so he's a very mild, moderate occasional drinker.
Well, and
at this
let's
point.
Talk a little bit about that, about moderation management. This is a program for people who are trying to moderate alcohol use, and you let them have meetings there at the Harm Reduction Therapy. You can go to harmreductiontherapy.org and find Dr. Pat Denning. She's my guest here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. And so moderation management is this sort of, it's meetings.
Mm-hmm.
People sit and talk, but people sit and talk about their drinking and their plans for drinking.
Right.
And how many counts they had, how many drinks they had.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of an AA meeting, this is not against AA at all, because that's an important thing as well, but it's a sense of you can't. Can't hardly say I had a drink. You better
right.
not say that.
Right, right, yeah.
You can't talk about your drinking really in an AA meeting, which is kind of an odd idea, isn't it?
Right, right, exactly. Well, and I think part of the effectiveness of moderation management, part of the beauty of it, is that they recognize that people have a relationship with alcohol, and that they may not want to break up. You know, they may just want to go to couples counseling. And that's kind of a way I think of it. You know, somebody walks in and they say...
Well, it is like a lover's, some
absolutely.
Have said.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And wives have gotten jealous of husbands because they feel like that alcohol is their other lover.
Uh-huh. Right. Exactly. So moderation management as well as harm reduction therapy really recognizes that there's a core relationship there. And for people who don't want to quit, that they have to manage that relationship and take out the self and other destructive aspects. And planning is the big thing.
Planning and sticking to the plan, and there's all these techniques and stuff
yep.
like that I read about. So I hate to sort of go to the negative, but I do kind of want to know in terms of your therapy practice and the therapist that you manage, if you've had failures, if there's someone who really is going off the rails and whatever you do can't... that. Where you feel like whatever we can do isn't working for them. They're not hearing us. They really need abstinence, or they really need, I mean.
Well, I would never withhold my opinion about abstinence from a person who was really struggling and being unsuccessful with any kind of moderation. That would always be on the table as a discussion point. It's like, you know, this isn't going so well. Can we revisit the idea that it might be better for you to not use it all? And so abstinence is always on the table
up, right.
for everyone. Yeah. Yeah. And we do have people who take a long time to change. You know, and you really have to hang in there and not give up. And frankly, in our community programs where we work with people with, you know, in our private practice, we work with just the, you know, general public. But in our community programs, we work with homeless, seriously mentally ill people. And they have so much else going on in their lives that, you know, our being able to affect their drug use is, it's just one little drop in what they need mm-hmm. in their life. And so people do get better. And people don't. And the thing is that they get to stay in treatment with us, even if they're not getting better.
Here's a question, something I thought of when I was in New York. You know, people in New York don't drive, right? They take cabs and they take the subway. And there's a sort of, and I think the younger generation, definitely the boomers have had to learn about the drinking and driving, but the younger generation, my younger friends here in San Francisco, they drink and they take cabs and they take BART and they take whatever and they don't drive. And I wonder sometimes, does that mean they're drinking more than they would? Like, doesn't it sort of open the door for people? This is sort of a little side note that I thought I'd bring up. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it sort of open the door for everyone to just drink as much as they want because they're not driving?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think people drink as much as they want anyway, you know, especially young people. I don't worry about
how
that.
How do you view Philip Seymour Hoffman's decline and then his death as a subject of much talk in the recovery and treatment communities, of course? And
mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what your take on that might be.
Well, you know, I don't have any personal or professional information about it. And from what I've been reading about the circumstances, the thing that stands out to me is that There's one rule that can prevent most fatal overdoses, and that is to never use alone. Mm-hmm. To always, if you're going to be using a drug, use with somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that was a rule he wasn't following, and I think that was because of shame. I think that he was ashamed to admit that he was using. He didn't want anybody to know. He certainly wasn't going to ask anybody to, you know, come shoot up with him. And if he had had a drug buddy, he might not be dead now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. One last question, that is, I'm talking to Dr. Pat Denning here on Out in the Bay, just a few minutes left here, and I wanted to know if the harm reduction therapy that you do, that you pioneered and created and are leading the way worldwide with, I wonder if there is, if you have anecdotal and statistical evidence that shows that it really does work, that harm reduction therapy is... it's working. It's successful for people.
We have a little bit of that evidence, and we have just convened a national harm reduction therapy research group that is going to begin, and we have our second meeting tomorrow. And it's about 25 researchers from all over the country who are going to dedicate themselves to just this question. Is it working, and how is it working? The data that we have, from a while ago, shows that people, the average length of stay is about 2 years. Some people 6 months, some people 10 years. Average length of stay is 2 years. And in general, the majority of people are abstinent. 55% of people are abstinent from their problematic drug when they end treatment, even though almost nobody wanted to be abstinent when they came into treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's a little higher than the results from standard treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, more people have a drinking problem than go to AA in this country.
Absolutely, right.
There's a lot of people that could use learning about harm reduction and moderation.
Mm-hmm. Or learn to abstain using a harm reduction model. Where it's our model is about choice and empowerment, a lot of different skills, dealing with underlying issues. And so harm reduction therapy is good for people who are wanting to be abstinent, because it's a comprehensive model. It's not just about folks who don't want to be abstinent.
What's the effect on you? I mean, are you happy that this is, that you're so successful, that this has become so successful and so interesting and people are flocking to it? Is it fulfilling to you? You feel like it's your life's work, I know.
Yeah, it's very fulfilling. And it's, I'm pretty old, as you can see. Luckily,
your picture's on the website.
Oh, okay. So y'all can see how old I am. But I've been doing this for over 35 years, and I'm not burned out yet. So
wonderful. It's such a pleasure to have you. I think you're just an amazing human being, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Marilyn.
Dr. Pat Denning, the author of Practicing Harm Reduction Psychotherapy and Over the Influence, the Harm Reduction Guide for Managing Drugs. Harm Reduction Therapy Center is in San Francisco. You can find out more at harmreductiontherapy.org. Check it out. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. We turned 10 years old this year. Sometimes it can feel like 50 when we don't hear from you. That's right. Our main financial support comes from you. I'm talking to you. Sometimes we crowdfund or get a small grant, but most of the time we rely on you to keep us going. So go to our website, outinthebay.org, outinthebay.com, and hit the tax-deductible contribution Donate Now button right now. Right now. Do it. Tonight, we're sponsored a little bit by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS. sfbar.org/LRIS. Make a tax-deductible contribution right now, like I said. And while you're there, go to our Playing Favorites page and listen to interviews with Leslie Gore. Yeah, she's gay. Ang Lee, no, he's not. John Waters, Judy Shepard, no. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, well, yeah, and many more. Our show airs and streams Thursdays at 7 p.m. Pacific. To hear it on your phone, go to the website, download the Stitcher app. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW. Joanne Marr is our engineer. Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.